This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
The Supreme Court hears a case challenging the FDA's rules for mifepristone as Donald Trump gets bond relief from a New York appeals court and a potential windfall as his social media site Truth Social goes public. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, columnists Alicia Finley and Kim Strassel. More than 60% of abortions in the United States last year, or about 650,000, were done via medication, according to the Guttmacher Institute. Typically, this involves the drug mifepristone. And the case, Alicia, at the Supreme Court today challenges some FDA rules relaxing the prescribing of mifepristone, allowing patients to get it via telemedicine and to get it via the mail. Let's start with a clip of Justice Elena Kagan asking a question here to Solicitor General Elizabeth Preligar.
To the government's knowledge, this case marks the first time, and I'm going to say, is it the first time? Is it the only time? Any court has restricted access to an FDA-approved drug by second-guessing FDA's expert judgment about the conditions required to assure that drug's safe use. Is it still the only time?
That is still, to our knowledge, the only time a court has done that. We have seen a disturbing trend of courts sometimes also overriding FDA's judgment to try to grant greater access to drugs when that overrides FDA's expert judgment about what's necessary to ensure safe use. And no matter which direction you come at it from, we, on behalf of FDA, think that courts have no business making those judgments in the absence of the kind of arbitrary and capricious error that would satisfy the APA.
And here is Justice Samuel Alito in a conversation with the lawyer for Danco, a manufacturer of the pill.
Do you think the FDA is infallible?
No, Your Honor. We don't think that at all. And we don't think that question is really teed up in any way in this case.
Has the FDA ever approved a drug and then pulled it after experience showed that it had a lot of really serious adverse consequences?
It has certainly done that. And, Your Honor, I think that underscores why the adverse event reporting, the post-market surveillance that FDA does, the ability that these plaintiffs have, even if they don't have standing, certainly if they are seeing patients who are presenting with adverse events, if they are doing studies that show there is some unknown safety component that FDA should acknowledge, they can take significant steps to bring that to the agency's attention, to bring that to Danco's attention.
Alicia, what's your view of this case? And I'm wondering if you can give listeners a little bit more background about what happened in the lower courts and how this case has now arrived at the highest court in the land.
So what happened is actually this drug was first approved in the waning days of the Clinton administration under the FDA's accelerated approval pathway, which is intended really for kind of emergencies or life-saving treatments that respond to or treat emergency conditions or severe conditions that are debilitating. And then the way that the FDA has typically used this accelerated approval track is to approve, you know, cancer drugs and such. So pro-life doctors, going all the way back to the Clinton administration, have petitioned the FDA to roll back the approval, and they've filed numerous petitions going into the Bush administration, the Obama administration, including the Trump administration, and have asked them to, again, roll back the approval. Meantime, on a separate track, you've actually had liberals petition the administration to do just the opposite and actually expand provisions for dispensing the drug. When it was initially approved, the FDA imposed certain restrictions on how it could be dispensed under what's known as the REMS review. And some of these included requirements that women had to get a certain number of in-person visits, and they had to receive the pill in person. And initially, when the pill was approved, it was only for 7 weeks. Now, in 2016, the FDA extended the gestation period cutoff to 10 weeks. It reduced the dosage requirement. It also reduced the number of in-person and follow-up appointments that women would have to go through in order to get the pill. Now, again, liberals continued to petition for more easing of access, while conservative and pro-life groups petitioned the opposite. In 2021, during the COVID pandemic, the FDA exercised enforcement discretion and allowed women to get the pill through telemedicine. And 2 years later, they decided, well, we actually haven't seen any side effects or increase in side effects or problems as a result of this. And now we're just going to say that we're going to remove the in-person dispensing requirement in toto. Pro-life groups, doctors sued in the Fifth Circuit appeal. A federal judge actually issued an injunction blocking the pill entirely, saying that the initial approval going back to 2000 was arbitrary and capricious, as well as all the later decisions, subsequent decisions that the FDA made. Now, the Fifth Circuit actually came and said, well, your 2000 decision, that kind of goes beyond the APA statute of limitations. However, we agree with on the 2016-2023 changes, and then they upheld the lower court's injunction of the 2016 and 2023 changes. And now here we are at the Supreme Court with the FDA or the Justice Department, as well as Danko, the manufacturer, challenging and asking the Supreme Court to overrule the Fifth Circuit.
One thing that the justices are zeroing in on is standing. And the lead plaintiff in this case is a group called the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. And Kim, part of their argument is that their members are doctors. Some of them work in emergency rooms, and they get called on to treat complications if patients who take mifepristone come to the ER, and they say that that's a harm. And it seems like some of the justices are skeptical that that meets the court's traditional steps for standing.
Yeah, so let's talk about what they say qualifies them. They're essentially making a conscience argument, as it were. They are claiming that because women might end up with complications and end up in an ER, that they therefore might be forced to treat them, and that moreover, by having to do that, they'd have to divert time and resources away from other patients and potentially face greater liabilities or higher insurance costs. There's good reason for the judges to be very skeptical here. Remember, to be granted standing, you have to show that you had a concrete injury. It has to be traceable to a defendant's actions, and it has to be able to be redressed by the courts. And I think the biggest problem here is just the conscience issue and the very tenuous link between that and what they are claiming happens as a result of these altered FDA rules. I mean, for one very obvious thing, they have not been able to show that there is some sort of increased risk that a woman ends up in an ER for cramping or bleeding because this pill was issued by a nurse practitioner versus a doctor. Okay, that's one of the changes that was obviously made. I think that the bigger issue is that they can't prove that there's anything that would happen that would actually, in essence, violate their conscience. Remember, they are not the ones, the ones who are suing, claiming that they might have to handle a woman like this in an emergency room, are not the ones prescribing the drug. And in fact, there is no federal requirement that they do so. If they are opposed to the dispensing of that drug, they do not have to be a doctor who does so. Instead, their complaint is that they might end up being in the ER when somebody comes in. Also, bear in mind how rare that is. And the FDA is saying that it happens in extremely small numbers of cases. But then for this argument to hold, they would have to claim that a woman was being issued a drug from another provider. She happened to be in the rare category of people who suffered a true adverse event rather than simply some complications or bleeding that concerned her. That this, again, went on beyond normal issues that come from taking the drug and puts her in a situation where there is an ER situation where a doctor has to complete an abortion. And then in addition, despite federal conscience objection laws that would in theory protect them, that somehow they are the only doctor that can then do this procedure, and moreover are unable to defer to another doctor who does not object. So that's the hypothetical that they're essentially setting up in order for standing to essentially apply. And it's not a surprise that they couldn't really provide any evidence that this has happened. So again, I think quite aside from the merits of all of this and whether or not there were violations, APA, et cetera, the question first and foremost is the standing question. The courts have been pretty tough on this issue. They need to be to sort of keep lawsuits in perspective and manage dockets out there. And this one seems to really be straining at the outer edges of what would qualify as standing.
Hang tight. We'll be right back with more in a moment.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. Alicia, what do you make of this question on standing? Because as Kim describes, the federal courts only adjudicate actual cases and controversies. There is no general right to go to court and seek relief for something you disagree with. You are a taxpayer and you cannot go to court and say, I don't like that government policy. You have to have two adverse parties that have something at stake. And so, Alicia, is that a place where the justices might go here, is saying that in this case, there is no specific doctor that is being pointed to who has a concrete injury? And I believe the Solicitor General made that case to the justices in this argument, saying that this drug has been available for a couple of decades now, and yet there's nobody that is being pointed to in this case who is a doctor who has seen that patient, and no concrete case actually before the justices.
I think that's exactly right. It's the issue, or the, I think the crux of the problem here. It's not just that there isn't a traceable injury to the changes. And again, when we go back to the changes, it's allowing non-doctors to prescribe in 2016, extending the gestation period, and then later in 2021, eliminating the in-person requirement. There's a lot of speculation, maybe an increase in women going to the ERs because of this, but there's actually not even really anecdotes, let alone, you know, data to back this up. So that's one issue. The broader problem is to actually grant standing in this case, you really have to eliminate any kind of limiting principle. I would grant, and some conservatives on the court, and Justice Alito has pointed out in the past about how the justices have eased their standing requirements in certain select cases. For instance, one that the plaintiffs actually raise as a precedent for why they claim should receive standing is the Department of Commerce v. New York case, in which states sued the Commerce Department over a question that the Trump administration added to the census about citizenship. And they claimed, well, potentially undocumented immigrants wouldn't respond to the census, and therefore this would result in a population undercount for New York, and thereby it would reduce their funding. I would grant that, like, I don't think that the plaintiffs or the new states should be granted standing there. But if you grant standing here, again, there is no limiting principle. Why couldn't, say, doctors sue the Energy Department or EPA for approving a pipeline that leaks, because they could potentially have to treat people harmed by that pipeline leak? The courts really have to enforce these limiting principles in order to prevent themselves from being inundated by lawsuits that really aren't cases and controversies.
Let's turn to the bond that was required of Donald Trump in this civil fraud case in New York. And Monday was the deadline that he was supposed to have to put up a bond for $454 million or face the seizure of his properties by New York Attorney General Letitia James. And right on time, Kim, Trump got a ruling from an appeals court in the state of New York saying that it would stay that if he put up a bond for $175 million. Notable, though, that the appeals court does not really provide a whole lot of analysis. It simply says that the previous judgment is stayed and we will let you continue this appeal with less than half of the amount. What do you make of this, Kim?
Yeah, not just at the right moment, right on time, but at the last moment, he was hours away from Letitia James locking up his bank accounts and beginning proceedings to go after his properties. So the court did issue this in time to forestall that procedure. It's really quite a remarkable turnaround in that originally, obviously, as you noted, this original judgment was for $454 million. That would have necessitated him posting a bond in excess of $550 million. He could not get a lender willing to do that because many will not take collateral in terms of property. And that's a lot of cash. This more than halves that judgment. He now says he'll be able to proceed. He'll either put forward a bond, which would require him to put up a fee and something about $200 million in collateral, or he'll put up the money himself. You're right that this did not come with any further explanation from the court on their views on this, but I would note that the fact that they dramatically changed this judgment, and also, in addition, they also put a stay on most of the other restrictions that the lower court judge had slapped on Trump. So, for instance, in addition to that huge fee that was rendered, he was going to be barred from running New York companies or obtaining a loan from a New York bank for 3 years. Similar restrictions had been placed on his two adult sons. Those are now also on hold. The one provision that the court left in place was an ongoing independent monitor of the business. But to me, this certainly signals some unease by this five-judge appellate division in Manhattan at what it happened at the lower level. And indeed, there were a lot of irregularities in this. It did seem to be exceptionally excessive. There were a number of rulings that the judge had already made that had been reversed. So I would suggest that this does portend a closer look and a potential change in this verdict.
Hang tight. We'll be right back after one more break.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Plus, save time by completing security questionnaires with Vanta AI. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ. That's VANTA.com/WSJ.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Another piece of good news for Donald Trump, and again, almost in the nick of time, is his Truth Social site now going public. And the news from the Wall Street Journal today is that shares of Donald Trump's social media company surged 40% on their first day of trading, giving Trump a stake in Truth Social's parent company that at current values is worth about $5.5 billion. Alicia, what is the theory of the value of Truth Social that is behind that? And can Donald Trump tap any of that value in time to perhaps satisfy some of this money that he now has to post into court?
When trying to determine whether a company is worth valuation, that's really kind of a fuzzy calculation. I mean, there are a lot of companies or EV startups that went public with SPACs and had ethereal valuations that were completely divorced by what some would say market fundamentals. They were losing money up the wazoo and had basically no revenue. So I think it's a little ironic that the press is now saying, well, the Trump Media and Technology Group, $9.6 billion valuation, at least as of Tuesday, is illogical. I mean, even while they were cheering some of these EV startups a couple years ago that ended up going bust. That aside, I think the theory, to the extent that, you know, markets are behaving rationally, investors are behaving rationally, is that, well, if Donald Trump is elected president, and right now he's beating Joe Biden in most of the polls, that the Truth Social platform would become much more valuable. It would become a mouthpiece for the administration where he would announce certain things and comment on certain things. Donald Trump was enormously valuable for Twitter when he was on that platform, as well as Facebook. And then when they kicked him off, I think that it actually hurt both those platforms in a way because it reduced the traffic and viewership among his followers. So I think the business case is that there will be a way to monetize the Donald Trump's presence on Truth Social. Last year only got $3 or $4 million in revenue. But again, to make the contrarian case here, Facebook hadn't commercialized or was making a profit at its outset for several years, right? And a lot of social media companies don't, and a lot of them actually are still bleeding cash. I mean, Twitter still isn't making a profit. Reddit, that went public last week, is still losing money after nearly 20 years in business. So I don't think that this is necessarily unprecedented. Now, could Donald Trump potentially use this to satisfy the judgment against him by New York? Potentially, there's a 6-month lockup period, which again isn't unusual for these kinds of deals. So he can't trade his shares or sell his shares for at least 6 months after the company goes public, which would put us into late September. Now, if he's able to appeal now the judgment, and nonetheless he loses on appeal, we don't really know when that is. But if the Truth Social company maintains its current valuation, sure, he could potentially cash out and share some of his stock to satisfy the judgment. He could potentially do that to infuse his campaign with more cash. It really depends where the company is trading in September. Right now, it has about $9.6 billion valuation, but that could crash for any number of reasons in the next several months. And so he might not be able to actually, you know, cash out and actually get a sizable profit that he could use to satisfy the judgment.
Kim, we'll give you the last word, but is this the latest meme stock, or is this a investment in a future social media site that conservatives could flock to? It's trading notably under the ticker DJT. And I think it's true that there has been much dissatisfaction with the policies, the moderation policies of the big tech platforms, including Facebook and Twitter, now X.com. On the other hand, drawing them to someplace else and running it as a profitable business is not a small challenge.
Look, I just think we don't know. Remember that enormous amount of Truth Social's income, to the extent it has it or can get it, comes from advertising. It doesn't necessarily have a model like Elon Musk is trying to get at Twitter, in which, you know, users actually contribute a little bit more for their check marks or certain services. I think social media companies as business prospects still have a long way to go. And Elon Musk is showing that and looking at that, which is, how do you monetize these things in ways other than advertising? Obviously, Truth Social has suffered on the advertising front because it was so closely associated with Donald Trump, but a lot of advertisers decided that they would boycott it for that reason alone, especially as it launched in the wake of the 2020 election and the January 6th issue. So it has certainly struggled to have to deal with that. But again, I believe we're still at the opening levels of social media and what they might be worth, if anything, out there as going concerns. So we still got a lot of space to run. There's a lot of people that think this is valuable simply as an alternative to some of the other biggies. They like the fact that that is what's there and that the market is providing an alternative. And that might also be behind some of people's investment interests in this too.
Thank you, Kim and Alicia. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.